Got it. Yeah. So I was just saying, I don't think there's a right or wrong or good or bad way of responding to the scores. I think it, you know, it's an experience in framing and posing questions and articulating possible problems or things to think about. And I think that's the value of that kind of work. And so I don't think we should, well, I don't feel kind of judgmental at all about responses. I'm more interested in what we can learn from the whole process of, you know, what happened with our scores and how we came up with our scores and how they were responded to, but then what we did with other scores as well. And as I was saying earlier, I just really enjoyed the process of going through what everyone posed and coming up with a way of responding. I just really liked all of the parts of it. Yeah. And I guess in reflection, like the last couple of days or so, it's made me wonder more about how illuminating it could be, but also how limiting it can be to even ask questions or to make a score. Like how does that already start to structure what it is that someone else will experience? And wondering if that's the same in art as in science.
Yeah, I think it is, and it occurs to me that a good score or an interesting score would be to make a suggestion and saying, but if this makes you think of something more interesting, do that instead.
Yeah.
Which is pretty much what, you know, people do.
Yeah. But maybe acknowledge, I think that's a really good point. So acknowledging, this is kind of reaching back to our penultimate exercise about iterations and how, you know, the score itself should be understood as being iterative. Yeah.
I think from a sort of practical perspective of having done quite a bit of performance in a very intense period of time, I feel like the thing that I can see now is that if you sort of are doing it as your work, if you're doing performance as your work, you always need a score. If it's not going to turn, at least for me, I always needed a really specific instruction if it wasn't going to just turn into
Dance.
fumbling.
Right.
Yeah. But if the score is good, you really do discover something else in it. You know, you really end up doing something more interesting than just following the instruction. There one call it, perhaps in the scientific rather than in the geographical way, a kind of discovery. You know, that a performance is good, maybe not for the audience, but that's the other thing. Kiss and Tell very famously said that some people have wonderful experiences having really boring photographs, have wonderful experiences making really boring photographs. So, you know, some artists might have really wonderful experiences making really terrible performances. But as an artist, you really do, if you find something that you didn't know was there before, then there's probably something there in the score.
I think that going back to last year, I think this is a really good example of emergence. That is, I mean, we discovered in that dance thing last year that if you make a couple of simple rules, right, and if you're clever about what kind of simple rules you make, the game becomes emergent. That is, patterns emerge that weren't in the rules, that as far as you could see
Yeah.
something emerges that wasn't there in the components.
Yeah. You
That's
just
the thing to shoot for.
that was the I think you described it before. It was a piece where you had certain instructions about where, like, you kept someone on your right-hand side, someone else on your left. Yeah. I've done an exercise or an activity like that as well in walking based, like teaching, but also workshops and things like that. And it's a similar thing, and it's based on geometry, on, you know, creating a triangle, an equilateral triangle, basically, with you being one corner and two other people being the other corners, but they don't know that they're the corners. And you do it with, you know, 20 or 30 people, and everyone's trying to maintain an equilateral triangle. And the only rule really is that you can't run, because it can get really dangerous. Like, people are just swirling and swooping through the space, and you can make your triangle bigger or smaller. You can be, we've done it outdoors. You can be, you know, a quarter of a mile away. And then at some point it just rests. Right? So it's interesting to see how it becomes a system that reaches stasis, or it reaches a kind of stability after a period of a lot of change, a lot of emergence. There's always one, everyone's numbered, and depending on if you're an even or odd number, you get to choose who your other two points are. And I can't remember how it works now. Then there's one person who can choose whoever they want, but no one knows who that person is. But that person is like, I don't know what you would call them in physics, but they're like
a crystal.
Yeah, they're the disruptor, and they can just do whatever they want, whenever they want. So the whole system has this potential to become completely chaotic again at any point. So you reach stability, and then it all kind of goes crazy again.
In physics, I mean, a very similar rule generates snowflakes, right? The rule is, if your water molecule, you know, you have an oxygen and two hydrogens, try to find another hydrogen to put opposite the other two, so that it makes a triangle, so it makes a triangular arrangement, right?
Yeah.
And yeah. That's that hydrogen bonding mechanism is where snowflakes come from.
Interesting. Yeah. The exercise that I do, I learned it in, it was like a summer school with climate and political activists and cultural people. And it was taught by someone who does kind of systems management education. And it was taught as an example of leverage, sort of leverage within organizations or within groups of people, like, you know, realizing, oh, that person, that free agent, has the most leverage in the whole group. And how can I, you know, work with what they're doing? Or what do I do if I'm in the group that has the least amount of leverage? Yeah. So I guess it's about analogies, right? About creating these analogies that are creative and kind of playful, but they're about larger issues, larger questions.
I wonder if emergence of that species of emergence is an example, or whether we should push the idea of it being an example of an invisible force.
Yeah. Yeah.
You make some simple rules, and then you see what comes out of it.
And yeah.
The force that drives that rose through that stem,
yeah,
is invisible.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I've been wondering sort of what we can or should settle on as a something to go forward with for the next stage of things. And I was thinking about the different things that we've done and discussions we've had. And I was thinking about sort of curiosity and creativity and that sort of kind of that drive as being something that's obviously common in all of them. But now that I think of it, emergence is there too. Yeah, so maybe emergence is an invisible force.
Well, and there's, at least for me in the process, there was an emergence, but it was also not teleological. So for your score, Jamie, I actually made those sort of, what I was squinting and I was trying really hard to get something closer to a contour I could maybe trace. And I did it sort of entirely with my eyes. And then I looked at that and I thought, well, maybe that's not enough. And then I took a screenshot of the thing, and then I went and did this, which was a much more sort of literal. But then I looked at it in comparison to this, you know, and I made, you know, and then I made this one, and I made this one. And in the end, I thought, okay, maybe the first thing was actually the best. You know, so there's emergence, but then, and then there's maybe the I don't want to say truth to emergence, the way that they used to say truth to materials, but there's maybe there's maybe something that rings in emergence, that that once you become a bit more rehearsed about it, doesn't quite work. But then I really did need the other five things that I tried to figure out that I actually had to circle back to the initial one.
Do you think that process of circling back and coming closer to what you initially did is abstraction?
That's a really good question. I think in reading not just the Chiardi, but Jess's entire text on, you know, what abstraction means in your sense, that was the sort of insight that I wrote for you, was that I think in a way, for me, from a sort of visual perspective, abstraction is, rather than it being about naming and sort of extracting that naming for the thing, for me, abstraction is about taking things that one that might be recognizable and then taking them to a place where words can't quite contain them. So I guess it depends on under what lens. Like for your score, Barbara, like I sliced the form. I sliced different pages of the form in different ways, and then I abandoned it. And then I took these birthday balloons that we had in the house for my boyfriend's birthday, and I was going to like try to like rip them apart and be a bit more literal about it. And then I thought, oh no, I really like the chrome, you know it. And so for most of them, I think perhaps for your score, Jess, I had the idea from the beginning and I sort of stuck to it, and it was just really hard to get through it to do the erasure, which ended up looking a little bit like a QR code. For most of them, there was actually almost like a circularity to the process, you know.
I think revisions are a form of annealing. If you're making a crystal, if you're growing a crystal, sometimes it's very important to warm it up close to the melting point and then cool it back down again, and you'll get a better crystal and so on. The patterns will emerge more cleanly. But of course, if you warm it up too much, it melts, and then you've lost the crystal completely. So that's a pretty good analogy, I think, to the process of revisions.
Yeah. Pushing something over the edge.
But close to the edge is good.
Yeah. I have to say, my responses to the scores, I felt really annoyed with the content, not with what you did, Jess, but with the content. Like the more I read the poem and read a little bit of background about him, the more it sort of drew out this very pointed kind of response. And so I felt I needed to construct it as a dialogue, so I needed to assume a voice in it, but it was very irritating. And after thinking and working a little bit with yours, Jamie, I felt the same way, and it's because I realized how personal that information is, like that it's like a fingerprint. And you know, I, for myself, I'm being, you know, quite cavalier with downloading that stuff and printing it off and everything. I think we kind of have to be, but I suddenly and kind of surprisingly felt very possessive about it. And I just wanted to obscure it, and I wanted to turn it into something else. And so, you know, again, I did lots of just photographing it with my phone and then sending it to myself and screenshotting it and doing it again over and over again, kind of like a visual Alvin Lucier's I'm Sitting in a Room kind of thing, where it just turns into noise at a certain point. But it was this kind of like defiant feeling that I had about what I was doing. And with yours, I felt the opposite. I just felt it was such an invitation to have a really nice feeling. And, you know, I tried sort of different scenarios and everything. And then last week, like the leaves were just so glorious. And I just spent all this time looking at them. And whenever I was outside, I would just stop and listen to them and just look overhead. And that became kind of this, the embodiment of what I felt the score was about. Yeah. So, yeah, so that's what the scores kind of opened up for me. Jess, how did you find that poem? Where did it, I mean, I know it was published back in the 50s, but how did you come across it?
It was on the first page of, or one of the early pages of a book called Physics for Poets, which was written by, I think, Robert Marsh. And I used it as a textbook for my Physics for Poets course at UBC. Because we had a course for third year art students, had to take a science course, right? And so the physics course, I taught that for a few years. And Marsh made this point that there was a problem, right? There was a little bit of animosity between the two cultures.
Yeah.
So I picked that up.
Yeah, it's good. I don't know that book, but it sounds great. Sounds like a great course.
It's a fun little book.
Yeah.
One thing I wondered about the poem and trying to respond to it was whether this animosity is some, to what degree, or this animosity might even really hold, because it seemed to me like such a modern problem, a modern thing for a scientist to have a problem with an artist, or an artist to have a problem with a scientist. Like, and it made me wonder how the way in which even people who are not even 10 years younger than me are sort of think so differently than I ever, because I certainly recognize that animosity. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that somebody who was my student would necessarily understand. Is it because of the internet and the way in which knowledge sort of like mushes together in all kinds of unpredictable ways? Like, and it made me wonder about even what the structure of what we're doing and how that in a way responds to a very different way of understanding information. While certainly for myself, I know that the way in which I understand information is almost the thing of the past in terms of how people are coming to understand information now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that things have changed. The animosity between the two cultures, which, you know, C.P. Snow wrote about, was a phenomenon of the intellectual elite, really, only. It wasn't the common person didn't really care, right? Mm-hmm. They're all just a bunch of eggheads, right? That animosity seems now to have drifted into a more of a cultural phenomenon, like Democrats versus Republicans, and the science versus art. I don't know. I think in the current battle, art is almost completely irrelevant to the people that are fighting.
Mm-hmm.
They fight over science, but they fight over science as a placeholder for all intellectual activity.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the nature of the conflicts right now, like all of the debates about truth, for example, and a lot of them based in dilemmas that are grounded in science, like COVID and COVID denial and climate denial, it makes me feel very fervent about the need for humanities and the need for poetry and art. It's like this is a very clear demonstration of why we need more of this and not less.
You guys are in a really good position in a sense, because in the current battle between basically science and religion, art is irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in the battle, it's irrelevant to the battle. That means you don't have to be in the battle, right?
Mm-hmm.
That means you can get on with doing something useful instead. So, you know, we depend on you.
You can be that person wearing the number with the most leverage. Right? You don't have to pick any of, you can pick whoever you want to be your other
exactly.
two corners. Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking about how in the 20th century, there were the kind of philosophical or sociological disciplines that aimed for scientific status. You know, like there was the scientific Marxism, there's sociology emerged at the same time and economics emerged at the same time, all trying to defend themselves or position themselves as science, you know, because I guess they're mixed with this kind of enlightenment secularization of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Science was where the future was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I make this argument too about how art's relationship to economics is fraught when we start explaining our value in economic terms. You know, like there's this example from the Olympics in Vancouver where there were deep cuts to arts budgets in the Olympics like ramp up, and so the arts sector would be like, we're against this because we produce $1.20 for every dollar invested in the arts. And I'm like, as soon as we start making that argument, we're lost, right?
Yeah.
If we can't articulate our value outside of a scientific or economic structure, then we're already admitting defeat. Mm-hmm. And so I think I haven't figured out how to make the argument for art and humanities in a way that's articulatable to a power structure.
Mm-hmm.
I just feel the pressure to do so regularly. And I think it's probably most of my teaching is talking around that kind of plea to students to take it seriously and feel feel the benefits of it, which might come back to the end of your score, Barbara, like do it until you feel contentment or inspiration or vision. And same with yours, Francisco, like do it until, you know, it comes back, the thought kind of goes up and comes back down. They're both kind of these warm spaces that I really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what that relationship is for abstraction or for what we want to get to, but those are just things that I noticed when I was doing mm-hmm. the work.
Yeah, so it's to, you know, to stand against utility and and also just to not be persuaded by the feelings of urgency that are part of the world today, like to be, to allow things to happen in their own time and not to force things.
Mm-hmm. Which is, I mean, borderline spiritual pursuit, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I like the phrase stand against utility. You know, I think that's mm-hmm. a really nice motto.
Yeah, yeah.
A kind of double bind for opacity, because I think even as it might be trying to resist something, and I say this as somebody who's choosing opacity because of that reason, but even as you try to choose to be, even as you choose opacity in order to resist against something, there's always something coming out the back that can turn it around and sort of try to make it profitable or you know, make an argument. Even thinking of like very kind of mainstream uses of abstraction in the mid 20th century in terms of it being an ideological tool.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, I mean, thinking of Vancouver in the 2010s, I think one of the things that moment did for me and a lot of people of my generation, and perhaps not exclusively, but quite specifically, racialized, migrant, queer women, was that we saw the writing on the wall and we fled, you know. And I think the thing that was unexpected or the thing that's been nice for me to observe 10 years on is that other people did come in. You know, it wasn't just an exodus, but other people did come in and they maybe had a different kind of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And they created spaces that at least in my view wouldn't have felt quite quite possible prior to, you know, in the lead up to that Olympic mm-hmm. sort of raise of the mm-hmm. of the ground. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, you know, I don't know, maybe we're ready to deal with that that moment now. Just like maybe Toronto's ready to deal with like the G20, you know, like all these things happen around that time. Mm-hmm. And there's a kind of strange historical silence around them.
Yeah. Which is not a good silence, right? Like there needs to be a an ability to come to terms with that, to reflect on those things that have happened and to make decisions based on what those were about. Silence isn't good if it's just ignoring the past or avoiding it.
Well, and in a way, I guess socio-historically, we each pick the wounds that we can go back and sort of excavate. Like even thinking about this notion of how relevant or irrelevant art is, probably the most relevant cultural conversation right now, it's actually around a stand-up comedian, right? And
yes.
arguments, scientific and pseudoscientific arguments around the rights of trans folks. Mm-hmm. You know, and the way in which actually like a gesture has sort of an incredibly smart, like Dave Chappelle, the heartbreaking thing about this is that Dave Chappelle's actually quite brilliant.
I know.
The way you know, he inserted in that.
I never really got him when he first came on the scene. Like I just found his humor is so over the top and kind of repugnant. It didn't appeal to me. But then last year and sort of the worst days of the worst lockdown and the worst days of Trump and everything, I just did this deep dive into his stuff and it got me through. And but then all this other stuff has happened now. So I'm back at square one. But I was thinking about what you said about opacity and there's this great line in Mary Poppins. And it's in the scene where she's come back from having some adventure with the children and she gets chastised by the father, the patriarch, right? And she kind of gets fired and she's going up the staircase to go and get her stuff. And he's asking her to explain herself. And she just turns around and says, "I never explain anything." And then just keeps walking up the stairs. So that, you know, opacity or silence or refusal to explain can be a way of countering something that is an unfair demand.
There's a famous story about the director of Fermilab who was called before a Senate subcommittee or something like that. And they said, "So how is this laboratory going?" He's asking for money, right? He says, "How is this laboratory going to help with the national defense?" And he said, "We're going to help make the country worth defending." Yeah. Which, you know, that kind of arrogance, you know, is sort of typical of physicists. But art should have the same arrogance, right? I mean, that's the reason you're here.
Yeah.
That's the reason you should be supported, rather. You're here for whatever reason you want to be here. But you should be supported because you're making the country, you're making the world worth saving. A little well-placed arrogance goes a long way.
Yeah. So what's next? We have our meeting on Friday, right? The seminar mm-hmm. on Friday.
It seems like we're splitting us up in groups other than ourselves. So are we each presenting what we have done to them? Or
I think so. I mean, looking at Ingrid's schedule, it looks like there's a couple presentations and then discussion of like a loose discussion of what we've done so far with different groups, just to see where we are in relation to them. That's what I assume.
That's how I read her agenda as well. And it looks like the discussion period's not going to be long enough for everyone to do a presentation. I think it's much looser than that. Mm-hmm.
speaking as a peg, I didn't find any holes that I thought I'd fit into.
Yeah. I think it'll depend on whatever groups we end up being mixed in with.
Yeah, I think we basically, I mean, what I don't understand, I mean, it's clear that in the discussion, we're just going to have to wing it, right? But
yeah. But
in, I sort of thought, I thought we were supposed to deliver something, and I don't know what.
Yeah, I thought so too, but I'm not sure that that's the case. So, I mean, I guess we could, if we needed to each talk about something in whatever groups we're in, we could jump into the Google repository and just pull things out at that time. I just went into the repository today, and for some reason, for the longest time, I didn't have permission to make my own folder, but today I did. So I've made a folder and I put all my stuff in it, so it's all up to date. And maybe if we each do that, then we'll have enough to work with if we're called upon to just talk about what we've been doing.
Well, I've taken everything for this meeting and put it into one URL where you guys can, you know, pull out whatever you want, just in case it gets inconvenient to find it elsewhere.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll send you an email, and I will email Ingrid and say what the hell.
Yeah.
What's going to happen on Friday? What do you have in mind?
Yeah.
Well, in the schedule, like the handout, the low handout, it says the second online seminar, which is the big one. Presentations are more granular, metaphorical, utopian, speculative, impossible, etc. Scholars, artists present alongside physicists, which I think refers to other, like particularly like Mimi and Ingrid and then other physicists. So it's not like us presenting, right? Which is kind of like I think that's the way I read it the first time. Yeah. Like we're going to have to make presentations to the entire group, mm-hmm. but it looks like it'll just be, you know, it'll just be Mimi and whoever else is scheduled to talk.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a breakout. We share work, meeting one or meeting two iterations. Mm-hmm. And then I guess we're supposed to have another meeting in December or later in November.
Yeah.
Where we give that second iteration to Scotty.
So is that the second iteration of what? Is it based on this one or is it a brand new one?
I thought the score was the second iteration.
That's what I felt too, yeah.
Okay.
And then we're also supposed to develop the third iteration.
Right. And is that what we go forward with for exhibiting in February, is the third one?
Yeah. So the January team meeting, which is us, I guess, mm-hmm. we share the iteration, the third iteration / final draft work for the low exhibition.
Okay.
So we can stick with this idea of I keep wanting to say scripts, scores. We're gonna have another set of scores.
Yeah.
Well, maybe.
That'd be fun.
Yeah.
I like the score model. I feel like it works really well, and it really allows for all of the different ways in which we work and the ways we approach things. I like the fact that, you know, things came back in lots of different formats. And mm-hmm.
Cool. I like that. And, you know, did we, because we talked about maybe even a publication as something we might contribute. So I think a nice collection of scores. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some of them are not visual though. So
that's fine.
Yeah. I think that was going to be our eventual topic, right? Just how to explain or how to exhibit invisible forces.
Mm-hmm.
So I think scores in a publication mm-hmm. is one way to do it, to kind of contradict the visual mm-hmm. tyranny of a white cube wall or museum gallery.
Yeah.
The other way to do it would be a sound installation if we're talking about mm-hmm. invisible forces, but those are like like small details we can work out.
Yeah, so we can think about that sort of for the next phase of things next month.
Yeah.
But yeah, something like an audio where we're each reading scores or something like that, and it's accompanied by a publication that also has the scores could be good. And yeah, if they want something else for the gallery, we could do graphics, wall graphic versions of things. Yeah,
I have plenty of drawings that have sort of come out of this. So.
Yeah. Okay, so maybe we can think about that. We can just ruminate on that for the next couple of weeks. And so the idea of scores again, and the idea of emergence, I think is, do you want to focus on that for the scores?
Sure.
I like it.
Yeah.
That's my favorite subject.
Sorry, go ahead, Francisco.
Well, it's probably nice to tie it back into something that I wasn't a part of the conversation at that time, but I love the idea of tying back to sort of previous rounds of low.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Jamie.
No, I was just going to kind of change tack and say that I'm going to invest, and basically saying it out loud so that people hold me to actually doing it. I'm going to look at diagrammatic thinking, like thinking about diagrams as abstractions and how they work within scientific histories as well. Like what happens when you diagram something.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll report back on that, but that could be an exhibition component. Mm-hmm. If we think about diagrams in a particular way, especially diagramming scores or,
mm-hmm.
Or responses to scores.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're all familiar with Feynman diagrams?
Mm-hmm.
That's a great example.
I am now.
It's a great example because, I mean, there's a lot of discussion now about the fact that Feynman diagrams are so ubiquitous in physics that people actually start thinking of them as actual pictures of what's going on, which they're not.
What's a Feynman diagram, Jess?
Feynman diagram is these things with a line coming in like that and another line coming in like this and a little squiggly line in between.
Uh-huh.
Them. I'll send you some references.
All right.
Yeah, I remember, was it the first seminar?
Yeah, that's what it reminded me of.
Mm-hmm, one of the, I can't remember which presenter, but that was the first time I'd heard an explanation of them and sort of understood where they came from.
Hmm.
What do you like about them so much, Jess?
Well, Feynman got the Nobel Prize basically for making cartoons that were rigorously equivalent to extremely complicated contour integrals in space-time.
Mm.
But the cartoon has rules, and the rules make it so that when you draw the cartoon right, you can make a calculation that is exactly equivalent to that cartoon that gives you a number.
Yeah.
A set of numbers. And that was so powerful that the translation of the mathematics into a simple cartoon, something that people could just say, oh yeah, I can see what's going on there. This is doing that, right? That was a magnificent introduction of art into science to make it more understandable. The problem is that people took that convenience literally.
Mm-hmm.
And it's getting to be more and more of a problem nowadays because people will argue about whether that particle that you see going like that, is doing this or has these properties. And it's just a cartoon. It's not real, And so it's the mathematics that actually is correct. The cartoon is just a wonderful way of making something that you can relate to, but you should be cautious about relating it to it too well. So, there are traps.
Mm-hmm. And they're both abstractions.
There are many examples of this where people take the abstraction as being real.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, rigorous cartoon is a pretty great phrase.
Yeah.
That's rigorous cartoon and stand against utility are what I wrote down today.
Yeah.
Nice.
Those are good. Yeah. Yeah.
I should also try to send, I don't know if you have copies of the invitations that we sent out for the last time about the, you know, find somebody and stand behind them, or, you know, all these different suggestions. I should give you that list.
I think you sent those, Jess. I think I remember seeing it, but maybe not.
I'll send it again. To you.
The document we do have.
You do?
Yeah.
Okay, so
I thought invitations like for the show. I thought,
oh yeah, yeah. Now I know what you mean. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you've got that.
Yeah, they're on this colored paper, right?
No, they're a nice
PDF
printed
like cards.
Cards.
Oh. Yeah, I remember. Maybe I'm just imagining that they're colored. On colored card or paper. I colored them in my imagination.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's an interesting idea. You can say, get a bunch of cards and say, what color? You know, a bunch of black and white invitations and say, what color should this be?
What color is it? Yeah.
Virtuality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well,
cool.
It feels like we have a plan. I like this.
I think we do.
I spoke to Scotty in the hallway and asked him if we were supposed to be forwarding him all our emails and how he keeps up with things. And he said that our group seems to be more on the ball than most. So it was encouraging.
Oh, yeah. Very nice.
Well, once I got my folder set up, I had a look to see the other teams, you know, what they had in the repository. And there are like three of the teams anyway, that don't have anything. There's nothing there. So I don't know. Maybe they're not Google people. Maybe they're Dropbox people and they're organizing it differently. But yeah.
I'm not really a Google person, to be honest. I'm sort of getting dragged into it now, and I've got there's a half a dozen Google groups that I'm a member of.
And, yeah.
And I find it really annoying that there's no way for me to tidily put those messages into folders, because the way I manage my email is I have folders for a whole bunch of different things on three or four different accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I move them from one account to the other, and I do it all with Thunderbird.
Mm.
Google Groups really wants you to use the Google
webmail. Google everything.
I don't like webmail.
Yeah.
So I'm having a problem with that.
Yeah, I don't like much about Google except Google, you know, Googling for information, Googling to get to Wikipedia. but other than that, I don't use my Gmail or anything like that. So this is the only activity right now that is using Google. But yeah, I guess it makes sense for the shirt project. So so Jess, if you want to let us know what Ingrid says about whether or not we need anything like a formal kind of,
yeah,
if we need deliverables for Friday.
Good term, yeah.
Yeah, what are our deliverables?
Yeah.
And if we have to put something together, then I guess we can each do that, but yeah.
I mean, I feel comfortable telling people the story of our scores.
Yeah,
yeah. Me too. Yeah. Yeah, me too.
I don't know if I could do it quickly enough. Anyway, are we done?
I think so.
Yeah. I was just going to say in closing that there are these really nice kind of diagrammatic elements on each of the four rectangles right now. I don't know if you can see my cursor, but on Jess's, there's that wonderful, you know, Amazon arrow underneath the lamp. Jamie's got, you know, fantastic bicycle wheels. And you've got this really nice sort of arcing wire, I guess, behind you. Mm-hmm. And up here, I've got sort of the bit of a sort of sculptural study from a few years ago. Anyway, these really nice sort of shorthand diagrammatic elements that are part of our worlds, our respective worlds right now.
I would use my virtual background, but I'll show you what happens when I try to do my virtual background just for a second. Oh, it didn't work at all. Hmm. Well, that's unusual. Last time I tried it, I just became...
Yeah, I remember you using it before and it was pretty sketchy at the edges. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, psychedelic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And not helpful. Okay, I'm going to stop the recording.